Okay, welcome everyone.
Nice to see quite a few faces here today. So today I'd like to present case number 29 from the Mumon Khan. Not the wind and not the flag, that's what it's called. So I'll read the case, then Mumon's commentary and the verse. The case. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks were having an argument about it. One said, "The flag is moving." The other one said, "The wind is moving." They argued back and forth, but could not reach the truth. The sixth ancestor said, "It is not the wind that moves. It is not the flag that moves. It is your mind that moves." And the two monks were stuck with awe. So there's a few people here that haven't don't really know what koans are and how koans function. So first of all, a koan is called a case. And a case is like, it's like a legal case. It's a precedent. So when koans were first developed in the Sung Dynasty China around 1200, they were taking sayings from old masters and dialogues and predicaments that they heard. They were collecting those, and the Chinese were really good at collecting and documenting, if you like, recording dialogues with masters and so forth. So they were taking those and compiling them into books, if you like. And these sayings and these dialogues have become known as koans, cases. So what they are, they're precedents. So there's usually a monk or a student, you know, with a master. And so it's a precedent of, like, what, you know, it's a precedent for us to discover right now, right here. What is it actually? What is this all about? So we have this koan, and it might seem so far removed to where we are right here in our predicament, in our world, in our worldview. It might seem so far removed. At the same time, from the perspective of Zen, or from the perspective of ultimate reality, it is right here, right now, and that is our task, is to discover that. So this is what a case is about. Okay. So here we have this case. Then Mumon, he is the compiler of these cases, if you like, of these predicaments, of these dialogues. So he assembled 48 cases. He then wrote a commentary about that case, and then he wrote a verse as well. And the verse is usually, you know, his take on what is actually here. So we can learn something both from the commentary, and we can learn something from the verse. So in our tradition, the case becomes itself becomes a koan, if you like, that is studied in Dokusan with a teacher and a student, and so is the verse in this particular case. Students only start working on cases, working on koans, once they've had an experience, without actually having had a glimpse of non-duality, if you could call it that, or a glimpse of awakening. What, if we haven't had that, then they don't make sense and you don't really start working on them. You need to have some level of attainment in order to get it. So those of you that haven't had a glimpse, and those of you that are new, this might not make sense to you. Okay. But Zen teaches from the top-down position, you know, like a lot of other Buddhist traditions, they teach from bottom-up. In other words, they teach from a phenomenological point of view. How are things working? What do you need to do to get there? Zen teaches, you're already there. Please open your eyes. Have a look. Look at it. So that's that top-down position, you know, a different approach, a different method of teaching. So here we have this case. I won't read the comment, Mumon's comment right now, and the verse right now. We'll get to that in a second. So first of all, we're dealing here with the sixth ancestor, Hui Neng. So some of you will have heard the story of Hui Neng already. It's a very famous story. He's the sixth ancestor in our lineage. The first ancestor from India that came to China was Bodhidharma, according to legend, should say. And this is an important thing to remember, even though it says he was the sixth ancestor or the fifth ancestor or the first ancestor. These are legends. You know, we don't, a historian might question all of this. Okay. But what is important is not the history. What is important is the message. You know, that's what we're interested in the actual spiritual dimension of what is being said, you know, rather than whether it's true or not. Whether it's true or not, who knows? Presume it's not true. So this is always sort of, we're looking at it from that perspective. We're looking at it with a critical eye. So this is not blind faith, if you like. But there is a message here, and that's what we are interested in. So Hui Neng was the sixth ancestor. So that means that six in line after Bodhidharma. And Zen transmission is passed on from teacher to student, all the way down to this lineage. It always goes like that. In those days, they had basically, and he was the last one actually, where they had one ancestor for the whole lineage. After Hui Neng, then it became directly teacher to student. But there is actually no one, and this is in the whole Buddhist tradition like that, there's no one that guards it. There's not one sort of authority in Zen, like the Pope. He might be the authority in Catholicism. In Zen, there's no one there that guards it. You have individual teachers that guard the Dharma, or that guard it, if you like, to a degree where they hopefully can distinguish between what is what is the Dharma and what isn't. Okay, so the story, just very quickly, because otherwise it might not make sense. The story of the sixth ancestor is that he was a poor, he grew up in a relatively poor environment. His father was, by all accounts, a simple public servant. He died very early, the father did. And so it was up to Hui Neng to look after his mum. He carried wood, and that is how they made a living. So he's a very, very simple farmer. People say he was not literate. The story goes that even as a child, he heard the preaching of the Diamond Sutra. And when he heard one particular saying of it, he had an experience. He had an experience that was strong enough and big enough so it changed his life. He needed to discover more. So he then asked permission of his mum to leave, and the story goes that they had a neighbor then that looked after the mother while he was away. He then went to a monastery, and he got to this monastery, and apparently he traveled 1,000 kilometers, and you can imagine, again, though the story goes, it's a good story. So he traveled 1,000 kilometers to get to this particular monastery where the fifth ancestor was. And he then asked to be admitted into the monastery, and there were huge monasteries in China in those days. And teachers always test newcomers, you know, in those days especially. And the story is that the fifth ancestor says, "How can a guy from the south even pretend that they can know what Buddha nature is?" You know, and then the ancestor is supposed to have said, Hui Neng is supposed to have said, "Buddha nature's got nothing to do with where you come from." And that gave the abbot already a glimpse that this young person at the time already had some level of understanding. So anyway, he was then sent to a rice shed to hull rice, Hui Neng. And for years he was in there just doing manual labor work. In those days, you didn't just come and sit. When you came to a monastery, you know, you started off with hard labor in order to really keep the monastery functioning, to get food on the table. So anyway, time went on, and the fifth ancestor decided that he needed to retire and to pass on the Dharma to the next person. Okay. And in order to do that, he decided that he was going to have a competition in poetic form. So whoever could write a poem that was the clearest form of what Zen or what this whole thing is all about, he would pass on the mantle, so to speak, the robe, as they call it, the robe. He pass on the robe. In those days, you were given a robe. Today, you're given a stick. So that's the symbol. Whoops, of the symbol of passing on the robe. Okay. So the head monk, and everyone thought that the head monk at the time was going to be the one that was going to win the contest. And he started off by writing a poem. And that's the poem that he wrote. The body is the Bodhi tree. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a clear mirror. Moment by moment, we wipe the mirror carefully. Let there be no dust upon it. So the body is the Bodhi tree. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is clear as anything. Okay, so our job, he says, moment by moment, is wiping the mirror carefully clean. Clean it all the time. Clean it all the time. Let there be no dust upon it. So that was his, that's what this is all about. Just keep on polishing that. Keep on polishing yourself. Keep on polishing. Then the story goes that Hui Neng heard about this and he had someone read it out. And after a while he said to one of the other monks, Hui Neng, who couldn't read, could you write another poem, you know, for me on this wall? He said, yes. So this is what he wrote. Bodhi really has no tree. Bodhi means awakening. Awakening. We call it the Bodhi tree because that is the tree that Buddha was awakened under, the Bodhi tree, the awakening tree. So Bodhi means awakening. Buddha comes from the same, that same root. Buddha, Bodhi, Butsudan, all comes from that same root. So it means awakening. Buddha means the awakened one. So it says, Bodhi really has no tree, he wrote down. The mirror too has no stand. From the beginning, there's nothing at all. Where can dust even alight? So this is his take. You know. And I won't go into it now because I've done Koans, Tatios on this, but you can see it is from another dimension. It is another level of insight. Doesn't mean the first one was wrong, but it is another level of insight here. You know. Now, everyone at the time was very surprised. Who wrote this? You know, who wrote this? And the fifth ancestor, the head monk, realized who it was, and he actually went there and ripped it apart and said, "This is no good." And the reason he did that is because he was scared. Because there's a hierarchy even in the Zen monasteries. He was scared that if it came out that this fella in the shed who couldn't even read or write wrote this and he was going to get the robe, others had been waiting for years and years and years, gone through all that practice, how can he get the robe? You know, he hasn't even gone out of the rice shed yet, let alone enter the meditation hall. So he called the sixth ancestor Hui Neng into his room that night, and he gave the robe to him. Said, "You are going to be my ancestor. But they will be so upset, great harm will come to you if you stay." So he took them across the river, and there's a symbology here, there's across the river, passing the shore, going, you know, crossing the shore, you know, and said, "Don't come back for at least 10 years, you know, otherwise great harm will come to you, and guard the Dharma well during that time." So now we're getting closer to when this koan happens. Okay. So 10 years, actually 15 years according to the record, 15 years he spent in the wilderness, Hui Neng. And what's interesting to ponder, I guess, is what happened during those 15 years? What did he do? According to the record, he aligned himself with some hunters. And he, as he was aligning himself with the hunters, he kept on freeing animals that they caught, so the story goes. And every time they got a meat stew, you know, he sort of substituted the meat with vegetables. Anyway, that's the story that is being told. But anyway, what did he do for 15 years? And this is actually quite interesting, because in many ways, what do we do once we've had an experience? We can have an experience that is so profound that we can come up with this and see this. There is no mirror. There is nothing at all. Where can there be any dust? If you see this non-duality with such clarity, you know, that's very, very profound. Now, some commentators on this say, well, he polished his insight. He polished his insight. And that is in many ways that we are doing when once we have a Kensho experience, once we've had an experience or a glimpse of the non of this non-dual reality, we are also following this process of polishing our insights. And we are polishing these insights through koan work. Every koan is a opportunity to enter that world over and over again, this world of non-duality, to see, to find out where is it right there in the koan, and to somehow go in there and clarify it. It's a clarification process. The other one is, what do we do with it? What's the purpose of it all? There's another thing. What do you do with your life? That's the question. What do you actually, once you've had this, what do you do with it? How do you apply it in your day-to-day life? One of the things I appreciate about this Zendo here, our setup, you know, which we mirror the Japanese setup from Zanbo Zen, is that this becomes an opportunity to resource ourselves. We come here, we sit, we get insights, we have this structure of meditation, daily meditation. If you want to sit in the morning, we have a Zoom system in the morning. In the afternoon, in the evening, there's a Zoom sit in the evening. Every week on Thursdays, Dokusans on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Senkais, and also Sessions. So the structure is there. All we have to do is enter into that structure, depending on our circumstances, whether we can or not. Some people do it more, other people do it less. Doesn't matter. Everyone does it according to their circumstances. And we start to resource ourselves with this matter, you know, with this clarification process, with this general process of moving ahead, you know, with the goal, of course, of getting that glimpse and then polishing it, getting clearer and clearer. And then from then on, we take it home. In itself, we are a sangha, but we are not. It's not like we're this group of people that are isolated and. Our sangha is the whole world. Each one has their own sangha at home, or at work, or in the traffic. This is just an opportunity to come and clarify it all for everyone. We're not sort of bound together like a monastery where we do everything together. Everyone has their own life, and that is how it should be. That is how it is in our tradition. So this is another question that everyone has to answer. Well, how am I applying that in my life? You know, if I had this experience, and quite a lot of you have had that experience of working on koans, how am I applying that? You know, this is something that is an ongoing process as well. So anyway, after 15 years in the wilderness, he decided to go back into the monastic world and to teach. So he heard of this master. This master was called Inzo, and he went towards that Inzo's monastery. And as he was entering that monastery, he saw two monks arguing about the flag. You know, is the flag moving? Is the wind moving? Which is our koan? That's how it starts. Okay, so this is where it goes to in our koan. So now, what's also according to the record, just to finish off the story here. The abbot of this particular monastery heard that this Hui Neng was arriving, and he got him to invited into his quarters, and he said, "Aren't you that fellow that got actually transmission, you know, from the fifth ancestors?" And Hui Neng showed him the robe of transmission. He said, "Yes," and the story goes that he then asked Hui Neng to stay there, and he became the student of Hui Neng. And so Hui Neng then started his career as a teacher and as the sixth ancestor. If you're interested, there is actually there's a sutra which is the sutra of Hui Neng. This is a really interesting sutra. It's the only sutra that's ascribed to someone other than the Buddha. The other thing that's interesting about that is it's actually the only Buddhist book in the Chinese classics. So China has got certain classics that they categorize. These are classic Chinese. That's classic Chinese literature, and this is one of them. This is the only Buddhist book that is in there. And also, as part of that, usually there's a commentary by Huey Neng of the Diamond Sutra as well. So this, it's an interesting one to look at. On that, you know, just on that, polishing our insights, you know, which we're doing at Koan work, also means, you know, occasionally having a look at these things, you know, especially if you've had a Kensho experience or if you're working on Koans, occasionally have a look at what is written by these guys. It's very profound. Mull it over. See what you can get out of it. You know, I'll read you out something that from Huey Neng. This is what Huey Neng wrote in the sutra that had a big impact on me when I read it. But it took me a while to really get this. You know, you can read it and go, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But to really penetrate that, really get it, took me a while, and it had a huge influence. So this is one of the things he says. Good friends, since time immemorial, this school of ours has first established freedom from thought as the source, freedom from form as the substance, and freedom from fixation as the basis. Freedom from form means detachment from forms in the midst of forms. So detachment from forms in the midst of forms. Freedom from thought means having no thought in the midst of thought. This is the key. In the midst of thought, because you can't get rid of thoughts, you know. Freedom of thoughts. As for freedom from fixation, while the basic nature of humanity is in the midst of the world, we're in the midst of the world, you know, with good and bad and beauty and ugly, enmity and familiarity, words and speech, offense and attack, deception and contention, one considers it all empty and does not think of retaliation, not thinking about the objects in the surroundings. If thought after thought, previous, present, and subsequent thoughts go on continuing uninterrupted, this is called bondage. Like saying the monkey mind. If you're stuck in the monkey mind, it's bondage. When thought after thought does not dwell on things, then there is no bondage. Thus, freedom from fixation is basic. Now, you can read that and, yeah, but to really get that. You know, that's what polishing means. Polishing your, you know, really polishing, you know, your attainment, your realization that you had up to this moment. The Koans do that. The Koans do that as well. Okay, let's get to the case. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks were having an argument about it. One said the flag is moving, the other said the wind is moving. They argued back and forth, but could not reach the truth. The 16th ancestor said, "It is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is your mind that moves." And the two monks were struck in awe. Okay, so let me just ask yourself that question. What's moving here? Is the wind moving? Can't see the wind. Is the wind moving? Is the flag moving? If you paint the wind, how can you paint the wind? Unless you have maybe a tree that looks like it's swinging. You know. So you can argue it. Is the wind moving? Is the flag? Maybe the physicists in this room, Jack, you might be able to explain it in mathematically. So it's an interesting question. Is the wind moving? Is the flag moving? So this argument, we're going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. Then Huey Neng came along. Huey Neng came along, listening to this, and he said, "It's your mind that is moving." And of course, we may have heard that before. We say it quite often. It's all up here. It's all up here. Everything is happening in your mind. It's all up here. It's your mind that is moving. So first of all, there's a problem. Okay, there's a problem. This might be a very, very simple problem. And it might be a banal problem. It's a problem that really, who cares whether the wind is moving or the flag is moving? But there's a problem. Okay. It's your mind that's moving. Doing the, to give you another one, which is maybe hits maybe home a bit better. Another example. During the last Dharma talk, I gave the example of Ajahn Chah being asked how he stays so calm. Ajahn Chah is a famous Buddhist, Thai Buddhist monk. And he was asked, this was at the time when he already had many, many monasteries all around the world, thousands of monks under him. And he was asked, how do you stay so calm? You've got all this responsibility. You've got all this, you know, you've got all these worries in many ways. A lot of people here have got worries at work, and we all have these worries, and some more than others, quantity-wise. If you're a medical doctor, we have a few here. Life and death quite comes into it as well. You know, we all have worries, you know. Like, so how do you stay so calm? And Ajahn Chah said, he looked around, and he said, do you see that boulder over there? And the monk said, yes. And he said, is it heavy? He said, oh, yes, it's very heavy. And Ajahn Chah said, only if you lift it. Only if you lift it. Now, this is the same level as this koan. Is the flag moving? Is the wind moving? Is the mind moving? So, it's very profound at a certain level. It's very profound at a certain level. But it does not dislodge the problem. It manages the problem. It does not dislodge the problem. Because it is another intellectual way of looking at it. That's why this koan can be seen as difficult, because you've got to see that. You know, to what degree are you managing your problems versus are you completely free of them and dislodge them? So this is the challenge here. And when we look at Mumon's commentary, he has grasped that. Mumon has grasped it, you know. Because in his commentary, he goes on and he says, where is the commentary? He gives it away. He says, it is not the wind that moves. It is not the flag that moves. It is not the mind that moves. Where do you see the essence of the ancestor? So he's contradicting. He's contradicting the sixth ancestor. He's one of the highest. He's one of the highest, if you like, at the highest level in Zen. And he's contradicting him. It is not the mind, it's not the flag that moves. It's not the wind that moves. And it is not the mind that moves. And it's the same as the boulder. So this is the challenge, you know. Where do you see the heart of the ancestor is a Dokusan question. Where do you see that? And you need to discover that experientially. You need to see that experientially. You need to be able to show that experientially. To go past the dualism. There is no mind. There is no movement. There is no such thing as a boulder. And unless you see that, there's no heavy. You are not free. You're still stuck and heavy. And I don't need to lift it. You're still stuck in that world of dualism. Unless you really penetrate that, you won't see it. That's the challenge of the koan. And that's also the freedom of Zen. You know. Because when I say the freedom of Zen, that comes back to what Hui Neng was saying. Thoughts in the midst of thoughts. Form in the midst of form. Of course we have these thoughts. But they're empty. They're just means to an end. You know, all of it is a means to an end, but we don't have to get attached to them. Once we see it, we see that they're just simple thoughts. We see that anxiety is just simple anxiety. There's actually, There is nothing to worry about. That's, if you see that, then you've uprooted it. You don't need to manage it. Don't need to manage it. So this is where this koan goes, and that has to be shown very, very clearly. So Mumon made a commentary. Sorry, Mumon made a, after that he gave a verse. The wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves. All have missed it. All have missed it. Okay. Now, of course, you know, really? So, and this is the difference between seeing it and not seeing it. You can't actually miss it. It's impossible to miss anything. But what happens is some people are aware of that and some people are not. That's the difference. It's all okay. You can't possibly miss it. You know, there's another story here, and some people believe that Mumon got this, his famous phrase here where he says, it is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is not the mind that moves. Where do you see the essence? There is a story here, long ago, again, it's one of those stories, we don't know whether it's true or not, but long ago, this was before Mumon gave his commentary, there was a nun called Myoshin. Not very often that you have nuns and females in Zen, so this is quite an interesting one. Long ago, there was a nun called Myoshin who was a disciple of Gyozan Ijaku. She was in charge of the guest house outside the temple. One day, 17 monks came from far away to see the master. So she had the master, and they wanted to see the master, you know. In the evening, they were discussing this koan of neither the wind nor the flag was moving. Myoshin was listening to their talk, disapproved of them all, and said, "You 17 donkeys have never come across Buddhism even in a dream." She gave him hell. She really, "You 17 donkeys." Then she said, "What a pity. What a pity." In reply to their request for, asked for instructions then from the monk, from the nun, said, "Please give us instructions. If you reckon we're donkeys, what do you think?" Okay. And this is what she said: "It is neither the wind nor the flag nor the mind that is moving. And apparently they all got it." So this was a group kensho. They all got it. And they never went back to the master, but made her the teacher. Now let's see if you can get it. "It's neither the wind, nor the flag, nor the mind that is moving." You gotta get the fact. What's the fact? Where do you see the essence of the ancestor? So, you know, I forgot to read that out before. In the second part of his commentary, Mumon said, "If you have a close grasp of the matter, you will see how the two monks, intending to buy iron, got gold, and that the ancestor impatiently set a failure on the spot." So it seems like he is criticizing the ancestor for saying it is the mind that is moving. Okay. So now there's a debate that happens in Zen circles. Did the ancestor say this on purpose? Is this like from the bottom up, like the next level before you get to a higher level, like that? Or did he say it as a fact? Anyway, everyone has to come up with their own answer on that one. You need to discover this yourself. It's not easy. It's not easy to get to this point. Anyway, coming back to the verse, the wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves. The wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves. All have missed it. They only know how to open their mouth and do not know that their words have failed. Can words fail? If you know the fact, then you know the answer to that. You know how to present this.